This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some remarkable stories to share, and you'd never know unless you take the time to ask them. So that's what we do each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And wouldn't you know it, I had to come to an Air Force town to get a Navy veteran's story from World War II. Atwater, California is where we are. In fact, just this past week, Atwater welcomed back another Central Valley Honor Flight of 63 World War II veterans from the old historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base. And that's a long way from Torrington, Wyoming, which is where Bob Ashburn grew up. Torrington, Wyoming. How many people were there when you were a kid growing up?
Probably about 3,000 or 4,000, a small town. I can kind of figure stuff by graduating. It was roughly 100 kids per grade. And of course, I didn't graduate. At 17, I quit the school and went in the Navy, as did most all of the boys in the class.
And you were the oldest of four boys in your family?
Yes. I'm the oldest, and I had the next two no longer with us, and I have one down in Key West, the youngest. He put 20 years in the Navy.
Now, I've spent a little time in Wyoming. I've been there in the winter. I know how cold and windy it can be. But what was life like up there as a young man growing up during the Great Depression?
Awful tough. Short food. There was no giveaway programs and all that stuff. You just toughed it out however you could make it go, and it was rough going. Families were closer then, so they helped each other out. But it wasn't easy. It was very hard.
And I imagine as the oldest of the four boys, you probably had to start working quite a bit at a pretty young age.
Whenever I could get anything. Started out mowing lawns, big lawns. Hey, 50 cents for a double lot, that was good. Or 10 cents an hour cutting spuds for the, you had the potatoes from the farmer's potato cellar, and you cut it up. So there'd be an eye in each one that was you cut up, 10 cents an hour, and then a little better money on picking potatoes. When they harvest them, you got 3 cents a bushel for picking them. So that was about the best job we ever had. The summer that I was 16, one of my good friend's dad and another guy went into a job of building an elevator. And so, of course, his son got a job, and he got me a job. We got $2 a day, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., minus 24 cents Social Security.
I thought you were going to say minus 24 degrees, but I'm sure you experienced that too. What's the coldest you can remember as a kid up there?
And we lived in town, but had to walk to school. I had my ears frozen a couple of times. I don't know if I even ever knew what the temperature was, but it was cold enough to freeze your ears, so that's pretty chilly.
You would need those ears to hear some big news on December 7th, 1941. I like to ask every veteran about that day because everybody seems to have some kind of memory of how we found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. You would have been 16 at the time. Where were you and how'd you find out?
I was working on a hay farm at the time. Somehow the farmers got the word. And they said, oh boy, this is really something. Nobody even knew where Pearl Harbor was. I know we had a big meeting down in the church, and they was talking about this stuff. No one knew where Pearl Harbor was. So that's where we started from that. And of course, I was, you know, not old enough then, but all the young guys were talking, oh, well, we wanted to get away from these small town stuff, I guess, because they said the Navy is the best place to go. So that's how I got involved in that.
So you heard everyone else talking about the Navy, and that's what you wanted to do.
Well, actually, this buddy that was working for his dad and that, he had two cousins that were in the Navy. They come home on leave and tell all these grandiose stories. That was back in the days when the best money you made was $21 a month. They was telling all this stuff, but of course they had to tell all these leave stories, all these places they got to go. I thought, well, hey, that's pretty good. Because I haven't hardly been out of Torrington, Wyoming. So I thought, here's my chance to go out. But at that time, you know, it wasn't old enough. I had to wait till the next spring. But it gets cold there. In town, I can remember, they didn't have snow plows. The people that lived down that street, they went out there and dug the street out so you could drive a car down it. And very few people had, you know, it wasn't a heard of thing to have two cars, family. There was no pay on that, but I helped shovel snow just to get it out so the guys could go to town.
Well, and if you're getting ready for another winter in Wyoming, then finding out that you're moving to California is probably pretty good news. And your dad was a welder, and they needed him at a shipyard to help put together some of these ships for the war?
What the deal was, you know, Yellowstone was, you know, across the state from us, but he did mechanic work for the Yellowstone Park. When this war thing come up, they needed all kinds of welders. So there was a garage in that town that he set up a place in there for a welding school. The story was out there that, you know, oh, you're going to make all kinds of money out there. So that's why a lot of the men in the town went into that school. Then he came out to California. The next summer, when I was out of school, we came out. That's how we got out here, and I have no desire to go back.
Well, and interestingly enough, once you joined your father in California, and he was in the East Bay around Richmond with the shipyards there, you tried to join the Navy, and they said, thanks, but no thanks.
He didn't stay up there too long because they found out through the government something that he was, you know, did his mechanic work. So they transferred him down to Santa Monica, California. So that's how the family moved down there. For me, now I'm pushing 17, so that's how I got started in the Navy. And then, of course, the story was, no room for you. So I went on to back to visit the guys into Denver and joined back there.
The story had changed. When they were telling you they were joining in Denver, you said, I'll get in on this too. So you end up in Denver, but you were a little confused about where they were sending you, huh? When they talked about Farragut, Idaho, that didn't sound like a Navy town to you?
You know, we knew about San Diego and Great Lakes and that kind of stuff. But we didn't know anything about, you can imagine, going up there in the woods and chopping out for five, not a camp, but five camps. Several hundred thousand sailors went through that. Of course, there was five camps. So they were really getting things lined up for the fleet. So then we take a aptitude test. Math was my favorite subject. So, hey, I scored high on that. And math and electricity, is they work together. So after I went through basic training boot camp, was sent to the University of Minnesota for 4 months of electrical training. Every month they graduated a company and then they had a new company come in. So they had four companies out there. They had 500 electricians at a time being made. So anyway, when it was through, shipped us all down to Norfolk, Virginia. That's where ship placement was. I said, oh man, I don't want to go in the Atlantic, but there was no choice. So they'd line us up every morning. The following name, men fall in square 27 or whatever it was. And then they were getting gunner's mates, electricians, motor max, you know, the whole thing. Because the fleet was screaming for help. So anyway, quite a trip across the country. 6 days and five nights. For the officers' help, their steward's mates, they only took the blacks in them. They did their laundry and their beds and their shoes and the food and all that. But so we start across the country, but without a dining car. So the first place we come to, they'd made arrangements to stop and go downtown for lunch. And now we're talking about 150 guys. So we go down and we go to the restaurant and they said, hey, not those blacks. And here I'm from Wyoming. I didn't know what they were talking about. Three officers in charge. Hey, this is the Navy, and we got the contract. You've got the contract for so many men, not blacks. So they said, hey, we're going to go. They said, you're not going to go in here. So what are we going to do? The officers rounded up enough money to send all the blacks down in the town to a black restaurant. Then a couple days later, we got a dining car, and that stopped that off. But that gave me my first education of blacks, I guess you'd say.
Well, your first education of the South and the racism that was still there. What city was that? Do you remember?
No, I don't know. We just come across the southern route, but I don't know what. But I'll tell you, I can remember we finally got a dining car when we crossed the Mississippi River. So it was several states. In our little town up there, we didn't have any blacks. In those days, no one got on very far. But it was quite an eye-opening thing. And now, see, another thing was, two-thirds of our crew was from the South. So, boy, no problem for them. But us, we couldn't quite understand how you doing this to these guys, but we learned pretty soon.
Well, my question was, since you made it through World War II, got out into the reserve, and then were recalled for Korea, by the time Korea comes around, the military had been integrated, was no longer segregated. Did you notice a difference at that point with the way black servicemen were treated?
Most definitely. Of course, some of the older people have been there or out, so they bringing in a new bunch. But I'll tell you, the ones from the South, they hadn't changed their ways a bit. That's the way I saw the thing.
So back to that long cross-country train ride, you finally made it out to the West Coast and the East Bay of California.
We come to Mare Island up here, and here's a ship, brand new, ready to go. But they had what the Navy did in those days. From the existing fleet, they pick a couple electricians and a couple gunners and nuclear crew on these ships to teach us guys. We had training, but we didn't know what the Navy was all about. So we had 30 experienced guys in one thing and another. And in our electrical crew, we had two experienced guys. We were lashed up to the dock, and we went down there and lit off the engines and that kind of stuff, and just went back and forth, tied up onto the dock. We learned that. Says, okay, now we'll take you out to the ocean. Went out there for what they call a shakedown crew. That's when you really get to know it. All the guys were very good about teaching us dumb kids what to do on this, and we were a good nation, good people, and willing to learn and all that kind of stuff. Here we are, making our own water, bread, the whole shebang from a bunch of rookies.
So you're talking about your ship, and this is a destroyer escort, the Lucky T, the Tisdale. Tell me about that ship and what your duties on that ship were.
One reason that this ship was very popular with the people with the command, it was a diesel electric. Two huge diesels down in the engine room that were shafted to big generators. They generated electricity into another compartment that had motors. Those motors were shafted to the propellers. If they needed a quick thing, in 10 minutes we could get going. We were in high demand because on these other ships, the steam, it takes them a while to get up steam pressure to get. So lots of times we'd be in something and in a TBS talk between ships. Hey, Tisdale, get underway. We got an emergency out here, say on some other convoy, not ours, but one that broke down, LST. Well, they didn't want to leave them out there alone, but you couldn't stop all the rest of this convoy, so they'd shoot us out there to circle around, keep the sub off of them. So that was a big reason that ship was like that.
Because of the technology it had in its engines. It didn't have the steam boilers. It was diesel electric.
Well, see, they were building so many ships. There was a shortage of this and that. This model of a ship was actually ordered for the British, see, because they had the bad sub deal there. But that turned out to work out good. And, of course, the Navy didn't know anything about this kind of stuff because there's no ships like that before. So this first part of these DEs were electric drive. We didn't care if we said, hey, go on, get out there and help those guys out. But it was a way we could get underway, and we used to practice this. The best time we made was 6 minutes from, say, go to being underway. Now, for a steamship, it took them a long time to light those boilers off, get that water heated up to a huge steam, and they were steam propulsion.
So this was a step forward technology-wise, but I'm just guessing if you were an electrician's mate on that ship, then one of your jobs was to make sure all that stuff, all that technology worked all the time. How often did you have to get involved in repairing something or putting something back together?
Not real often, but see, any kind of electric stuff, it's got the brushes that run on the commutator, and of course they wear down. Then they had inspection plates on there where you'd have to take that off and get in there. Oh, you taped up your hands because we did it with sandpaper. We went all through the war with that same old beat up ship. We were underway day after day after day after day. So there's lots of wear and tear on all that stuff. But that bugger held up good all the way.
And you were part of the original crew, and you like to tell people you made 9.5 invasions, so we're going to have to get the story of how you had a half invasion. But before that, I don't know if you can remember this, but here you are a teenager, and you're heading into a war zone on this ship with all these guys you barely know. Do you remember what that felt like? Were you thinking you were going to come home again, or were you saying, boy, I don't know what's going to happen here?
Well, I think partly because we were so not dumb, but uninformed, didn't know. Because I remember at Tarawa, we got in there, that Japs didn't come after us much in the daytime there, but they'd have those night raids. So we'd go to general quarters, us newies out there gawking around. The old guys with a little bit of experience, boy, they're diving behind a cover. You guys better get under cover. The engineering force had to provide so many guys for the gunnery because they didn't have enough help. So 1/3 of the electricians went into the gunnery gang. I went into the gunneries, but for on the depth charge racks. So that was my job there. When these guys were saying about jumping behind those depth charge, we says, hey, you know, every one of those things is 300 pounds of explosives, but back at Mare Island, they took us out on the range and told us. So they set up a depth charge out there and started shooting on it with a machine gun. It punched all kinds of holes in it, but it didn't set it off. And they says, hey, remember this. There's a little detonator in there, about that big. That detonator sets off a booster. The booster sets off the depth charge. So if that plane's coming in strafing you, you don't have to worry too much about it because it's got to hit a little thing that about that big to set it off.
It's time for our first commercial break. If you'd like to check out some photos of today's guest, Bob Ashburn, go to the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com. We'll find out about his closest calls aboard the USS Tisdale when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 90-year-old Bob Ashburn of Atwater, California, originally from Torrington, Wyoming. He's a Navy veteran of World War II, participated in 9.5 invasions aboard the destroyer escort USS Tisdale, nicknamed the Lucky T after making it through the entire war. When we left off, Bob was talking about how he and the other young sailors couldn't help but stand up and watch when they got their first taste of combat at Tarawa.
On the shore, the Marines had set up big searchlights, so when those planes would come over at night, they'd search, they'd get them spotted, and then they were firing at them, and we were firing at them too. But at that time, radar wasn't as good as it was later on, but I never ever saw one shot down. But you see the explosion close by them, but that was kind of the setup on that. It was just something new to us, and we wanted to see what's going on. Dumb kids.
Did you hit a point where you said, oh boy, this is pretty scary. I don't know if this is going to work out all right.
Yes, probably by Saipan and Tinian. So we went through Tarawa, Kwajalein, and Eniwetok. Not much problem to us. But when we got to Saipan, then that was another story. They started to lay it on us pretty heavy. And our biggest thing was there, the subs would come. See, because this outfit that we were really watching was this 6 big troop ships of floating reserve. Well, you just can't leave those swinging around for fuel usage. So they'd come in and anchor every day. We'd just cruise back and forth for anti-aircraft, and sub protection.
So you are protecting those six troop ships. That was the duty of your ship.
That's the main thing we had, because at night we would take those troop ships out, because that's when we'd get the raids mostly, and we just go back and forth, back and forth. But here's the subs over here. They knew they couldn't get in too close to us because, you know, we had the underwater sound gear, and we could sound them, and then flag would say Tisdale, go, and Elise, whichever ones. Maybe two of us would leave the convoy and go back hunting those Jap subs. We'd get a sounding. It's something like air radar. A sound goes off, ping, and if it hits something, it bounces back. Then they measure that how long, and it's, oh, they're 1,000 yards out here. So that's where you charge for them. Then we get over there and get the contact on them. We had what they called a 13-charge pattern. So they'd come down from CIC. There's 4K guns on each side and two racks. So there was 10 setters on those devices. You had to set them up to whatever the sound gear people told them how deep they were. So then we'd set, okay, set for 30. Had a spanner wrench, you put on there and set it, 30. You had to train in the daytime, because what are you going to see at night? So, but we go click one, that's 30. Click two is 50. Click three is 75. No talking between any of those guys, but we had one talker. He'd get the word down from CIC, and that guy would say, hey, change setting to 70, 75. We'd do it just by listening. Click, 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 and then you know you're there. The thing was, we thought we'd get them, but you didn't know for sure, because see, if they low down and lay on the bottom, you can't sound them off the bottom. They have to be up where they're a thing, you're hitting them, that thing's coming back. So we thought we had two possibles out there. But then, next thing they pulled on us, the subs would come in there fairly close and shoot random shots at us and those troop ships. A guy, a good friend of mine, he's two decks up on an aircraft gun. He says, Bob, one night I got two of those torpedoes coming at us so close. He says, I screamed so loud he thought the whole ship heard him. That size of ship, it's only got about 3/4-inch metal on the outside, and it would just blow you apart. That was pretty damn scary, because they'd shoot them at you, and only the guys up higher could see them, you know, because they make quite a wake in the water. But that's when the first action really started for us.
That was at Saipan?
Yeah, Saipan. And like I say, every night we'd take these spare troop ships out and just go back and forth. Oh, and we're surrounding them, just like we do when we work with carriers. You have to have somebody, you know, all around them to get those soundings. At daylight, we'd bring them back in. They'd anchor. If we were assigned anti-aircraft, we'd anchor also. But if we were assigned subbing, we'd just go back and forth out there. But one of these times when we anchored, and then come that evening, you go, Tisdale, get underway. Tisdale, get underway. Well, we were yanking on that anchor, and all we could figure, it must have hung up on a ship we'd sunk when we went in there. We couldn't get the damn anchor up. So they had to call the shipfitters up there with torches and cut that one anchor off. On the bow of the ship, there's two anchors, one on each side. So from the rest of the war, we went around with one anchor.
And if they hadn't cut that off, you guys would have been stuck there. Would have been a real easy target.
Oh, hey, we'd have been dead targets. Those tubs could have picked us. See, we had a really sharp captain. You don't try and run away from those torpedoes. You try and head into them. Here, you're going this way. These torpedoes are coming this way. So, but if you go this way, you can possibly straddle them. And that was what, boy, our captain was good. And it was the same thing later in the war for that same kind of maneuvering for aircraft attacks. That smaller ship, we had it over those carriers and those guys. On the top of the fact that the Japs wanted to knock out the carriers, they can't maneuver. You know, here's this big, several hundred feet long ship. Say the difference between an 18-wheeler or a car out on the road. The guy can maneuver over. We could maneuver around, and we did. Boy, we was just circling all this kind of stuff. That's on these air raids. But we didn't get much of that until the latter part of Saipan.
You mentioned that anchor there. I know another thing you saw, and maybe you saw a little bit of this at Tarawa, too. Tarawa was such a bloody battle and an often overlooked one, and I guess you guys got there probably on the tail end a little bit, but I bet you saw some of the carnage. And here you are, a teenager. What did you see, and what did it feel like?
I'll tell you, that hurt you bad. I'll never forget it. Damn bodies laying around. Flies all over them. See, at the first, they let us go ashore, you know, get off the ship for a little bit. But that's all you saw. Here's this bulldozer building, digging big ditches, and just bulldozing those Japs in there. But the American guys, they had some grave outfit that found out who they were and that. But some of them were so blown up they couldn't tell. You see the in the graveyard there, U.S. Marine, unknown. There wasn't enough of them left to find out. It was terrible.
Can't imagine being an 18-year-old and looking at that and feeling so bad for them and their families, and then probably also thinking that could be me.
Yeah. Fortunately, we didn't have any guys aboard that had relatives in the Marines or that. But some of my schoolmates did. It's hard to say how bad you feel. But basically, we're just hoping nothing happened to us, and it didn't. That's why they called us the Lucky T.
Well, and it wasn't because you weren't in some sticky situations. I know that you were. And one of the notes I know you've written down about Saipan was bodies floating in the water there.
Now, you want to talk about something tearing you up. This is babies and women and so many. We was trying to drive around through them. They were just thick, and you couldn't do it.
Is this where they were jumping off the cliff, below that?
They jumped off the cliffs, and then I guess when the tide come, it would wash them out. But it got so bad, several of the ships got orders to put gunner's mates out there, stood out there and just shoot into the bodies so they'd sink, because they was floating there. And I'll tell you, so much of that, it gets out to you. You never forget it. They had those people so brainwashed. I think there was some kind of a word around. To be able to get in the Marines, you had to kill one of your family members or something like that. And they had those people believing that. So here they go. They go down there with their kids in their arms and jump off those cliffs. Then, I don't know however they went, but then we got the assignment one day to take a battleship and escort them past those cliffs. And now this is with these 16-inch guns. Boy, they shoot a projectile out like a ton. And they got 12 of those guns. So what we went by there, and they just start shooting that cliff off to break that cliff down, so they couldn't at least do part of that. But they still had some pretty big caves there, because the next time the assignment come around for the battleship to go around, we didn't get it, but another outfit did, and there were still enough Japs in there that they shot up two of our ships. But that was the only thing they could figure to do. But just to shoot those cliffs down and get their fortifications out.
And you described for us, and people heard the emotion in your voice, how difficult it was at Tarawa when you saw the carnage there. And I'm sure it didn't make you feel very good about the Japanese. But when you got there to Saipan, and you're seeing women and children, civilians, who are killing themselves because of the propaganda they're being fed about what would happen to them if they didn't, how angry did that make you with the enemy?
After so long, you get a little bit hardened into it. So between Saipan and Tinian, it's about a 2-mile reach in there. But they spotted gathering of troops over on this shore. So they says they must be going to go back and try and get across and reinforce their guys. And one night, we encountered two barges of them and just slaughtered them. And didn't hurt us at all. But you get toughened into it a little bit more, but it didn't bother us that much because of all the things they'd done to us. Oh, because also we had terrible losses on Saipan. So he says, hey, this little give back.
And you were there, and the rest of us were not. So all of these stories have some value and help us understand how real this was, how taxing it was, what an impact it had on you and the rest of you guys on your ship and on the world. And one of the places you moved on to was Guam. You saw another way that guys could lose their lives in war. You saw a Navy plane that was coming right at your ship?
Saipan, Tinian, and Guam was one operation. I think they call it Iceberg or something like that. I forget what it was. But we worked Saipan first, Tinian, and then we went down to Guam. And what we were assigned down there, artillery support for the Marines ashore. And they had this map, and then we had the same map, and they said, hey, give us some support in X5 or whatever it was. And so we'd cruise up there and just shoot, because Guam is quite forested and that stuff. You couldn't really see, but they'd say right on, or hey, so much left, right, or whatever. And that's what we'd do on that. But then every so often we got to go in and get some supplies and stuff. And this one time we was going in there to get the whatever we was going to pick up, supplies and that. But here's these flyboys, you know, they're doing their practicing too, you know, running, boy. And I mean, when I say they just clear your mass, that's what they do. They do their strafing, like we got strafed later on. But anyway, here this guy come by, and boy, was out there looking at it. He was buzzing. Just as he got over us, whatever happened, one wing peeled off, and he punched into the shoes. See, we were going in the harbor, and he's just crashed ahead of us. We got there in just a couple of minutes, but all he had just time to pull some lever to put out a die. It was yellow. We went up there and looked, but hey, he was going at a speed, you know, 300 or something, that it drove him in the water. And there was nothing ever went. But here's a guy, you know, not at war or anything like that. You know, yeah, at war, but not in a battle.
He was just practicing his strafing runs, and then yeah, boom, he's gone.
Just practicing this, and just some damn thing went wrong, and that was the end of it.
You mentioned Saipan and Tinian and Guam. It was somewhere along that path that you had your half invasion, right? How did you end up with 9.5 invasions that you took part in?
Here, between Saipan and Tinian, at this end of Tinian, they had some fortifications. That was the low island where, back in the good Japanese time, they had the farm fields. And then over on Saipan is where they had the big factory. They used the land good, because Saipan wasn't much of a place to grow stuff. But that deal was there. So then when it gets down to where they're getting kind of tight to do this, that's when we went and took reserve ships up to the other end of Tinian. And we thought it was an invasion too. We did our usual shore bombardment and that stuff. Then when they put those guys down, and they're all scheduled out pretty damn good. Here's the first wave, you know, quite a bunch of guys in those landing boats. So they'd go on there, here comes the second wave, here comes the third wave. I said, boy, they're really going to raise hell with them down there. But we had eyes on that depth charge rack, oh, because we were at general quarters. Oh, I could look right out there and see, well, all the guys on deck could see what's going on. And those boats started turning around. We said, what are they doing? And here, then the second wave, they turn around and come back. Which, boy, they must have really ran into some opposition down there. So they just decided to back up. They get back, and see, the Swabbies weren't in on this thing. The officers knew. But then they told us, hey, that was just a mock thing to split the Jap forces to come and try and stop this end of the invasion. And then up at the other end, the guys were driving down. It worked, because then that shortly ended Tinian, that wiped them out.
And you mentioned where your general quarters station was. So it's the depth charge racks on the port side. So you're up top side, and you could see just about anything, huh?
Oh, yeah. That type of a ship, you're above the water, the main deck, about 7-8 feet. You got a good view of all that stuff.
From that perch at that port side depth charge, when you're at Okinawa and the kamikazes go into a swarming frenzy, you probably saw quite a bit of that.
My gut tied up in a knot. Some guys showed stuff outwardly, and boy, they're smoking cigarettes. I never smoked. But they were just puffing on those cigarettes. I don't know what they're getting out of it. I never showed anything outwardly, but my gut was tied up in knots from nerves, I guess.
When the kamikazes came, can you paint a picture for us? Can you tell us what you saw?
Basically, they were after those carriers. I could show you some numbers in here. You know, we're not talking about, like I hear about these few strikes they're doing over in the Mideast. We're talking about several hundred planes a day. Now, the fleet is broke up into so many pieces. Like, let's say when we were working with carriers, there'd be 6 carriers and about, 15, 18 escort ships all the way around them. The reason for that, whenever they decided to launch into the wind, they had protection no matter which way you turned.
We're learning a lot today, aren't we? And there's more of that to come and more emotion to come. How close did Bob Ashburn come to a kamikaze attack claiming his life? We're going to find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Woodlawn.
We're not gathered here united tonight because of the name of our teams or of our schools, but because of the name above all names. Jesus.
Witness the true story of a spiritual awakening that saved a high school and shook a city.
Look at the changes to these boys, Owen.
This is what happens when God shows up.
Woodlawn, now showing.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch now with 90-year-old Navy veteran Bob Ashburn. He grew up in Torrington, Wyoming, but Atwater, California is where he and his wife Edna have been since 1957. You'll find a photo of that happy couple at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we left off, Bob had given us a little insight to the massive scope of the kamikaze phenomenon at Okinawa, his final battle aboard the USS Tisdale during World War II. So you saw kamikazes hit other ships. You saw kamikazes get shot down. How close was this all happening to you?
The closest one, I thought, oh, hey, and I'll back up. But this was the one that really... This guy was coming on to us from astern. That's the least way we could get any firepower going. And we're back there standing up. Here's the depth charge racks and there's two guys here. And that bunker was coming in on us. Oh, man, this we're probably going to get us. But about maximum 50 yards away, that guy was still coming down on us and strafing us. And you look up there and you see on his wings just sparks coming off. Looks like sparks coming off there, but that's and of course that's to, you know, try and knock down our guys. When you see that, and about 50 yards away, I said, oh boy, he was coming head on into us. But we got a direct hit, must have hit on his bomb, because that plane just blew up and throwing, you know, parts of it, splashing all around us, but he didn't make it there. Then other times they were pretty close. How we could see there, when you see those sparks coming off their wings, hey, they're then when you go out and you're hitting them, and you're hitting, you know, some aluminum with this bullet, it's like little white puffs of smoke coming off. When they get in that close, then you know they're getting on you. But as this fleet is, here's this bunch and there's that bunch and that, you know, a few miles apart. But whichever one they picked on, that's the one that caught the worst. You're just hoping they'd pick on somebody else. Now, the next thing, a lot of people don't kind of know either, the kamikazes, they were one chirp. They just went and that was it. But then in these same raids, they'd had their regular Air Force, you know, their bombers, torpedoes. They did their thing and turned around and went back. We're talking hundreds a day. So when I hear about these little airstrikes back in the Far East, it's peanuts. We had hundreds of raids. But there's one time there, we were at general quarters for 40 solid hours. They're trying to get you. You're trying to stop them.
Can't imagine what that feels like. I mean, there's got to be part of you that says, there's no way I'm going to make it through this.
Well, at Okinawa, almost constantly, there were so damn many of them, and they just kept coming. They had 2,500 planes, like, lost in just to Okinawa. And you get 2,500 planes, after, you know, your odds get... We just kept thinking, well... Hey, now, see, because we lost half of our squadron. We thought, when the hell are we going to be next? But we lucked out.
The lucky T. And you told us about one of those times where you were very fortunate with that kamikaze coming straight at you. He's strafing you. And you said 50 yards away, he blows up because one of your guns hit him?
Yes. On this size ship, the biggest gun was a 3-inch. It had to be a hit from... this one aft gun that was shooting back. Now, see, over on the sides of them, they could have the 20s and the 40s pound them, but to blow them up like they did, we figured he had to hit the bomb because, I mean, it just blew up. Hey, and enough, close enough, got slapped in the face from the concussion. When it's like that, that's pretty damn close.
So you felt it. When it exploded, you felt that.
Oh, yeah. Just like slapping you like that.
So a few questions here. A... if that gunner doesn't hit that plane, What would have happened?
It would have wiped out that whole, see, the K-guns, four on each side, and then that first, see, that gun that got him, he was one deck up, but it would have wiped them out, too. Hard telling how far, but it see, that kind of a ship can't take bad damage.
Would you be here? Would you be sitting here talking to me if that guy hadn't shot him down?
No.
What if they had shot him up, but not blown him up? In other words, hit him, disable him, but not explode him.
He would have still went in. Because, see, that was the deal. They knew they was going to get shot at. If they're strafing or anything they're doing, didn't do anything. Because when that plane comes down, say the bomb goes off, the plane crashing into you, and then that gasoline burning. So it's...
Well, I don't want to exaggerate, but I'm just listening to you recount this story. And it sounds to me that shot that gunner had on him was kind of a one in a million shot. If he hits him anywhere else on that plane, you're not here.
Yes, most definite. After this is over, us guys back there talk. We says, hey, that was it. We thought, bad. And you go through that day after day.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've heard a lot of different perspectives on this. When you go through something like that, when you live through that and you realize how close you were and how nearly impossible it was for your life to be spared in that moment, yet it still happened. Do you feel like someone was looking out for you? Was there someone there protecting you?
I said my prayers every night, and I've said the same prayer ever since. It was just by the grace of God we made it. That's all I can figure. Here are these buddy ships, they're getting wiped out, and you just say, well, we lucked out that time. Lucky to you.
And you never would have met your wife? You never would have had kids, grandkids, a great-grandchild?
It's been a good life. Got one hell of a good wife. I'll tell you that. It's just unbelievable the way things can happen and work out for you. Have a nice family, nice wife. And fortunately, made it through it all that. We didn't live high, but we lived good. And I still was saying the same prayer.
I know that you stayed in for a couple of years after World War II. You went into the reserves. You got recalled for Korea and spent two more years at wartime in the Navy. But many, many years later, you got to experience something that more and more veterans are getting a chance to do, the Honor Flight. You went with Central Valley Honor Flight to Washington, D.C., to see the World War II Memorial, that wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't come home. And you just told us how close you were to not coming home. What was that experience like for you?
Same as I'm going through now. It brings back all that old bad stuff. I think it's a wonderful thing they did. And as soon as they got in touch with me for donations to start building that, I said, hey, it's about time, and we've always supported that.
And when you say donations, you're talking about the memorial, because a lot of people don't know. They assume that the government built that memorial. No, that's $190 million of private money, mostly from World War II veterans like yourself, to build that memorial.
Yeah.
And sorry, I know I interrupted you. I wanted to make clear people knew you donated to the memorial, not to Honor Flight, because Honor Flight won't take a penny from a World War II veteran unless you take a free flight first. And that was an idea. They took you there to show you that memorial, the other memorials, the changing of the guard at Arlington, and hopefully send a message of thank you and that we get it. Thank you for serving our country, and we owe you a debt of gratitude. Did that feeling come through for you?
I would say I used my grandson for a guardian. I wanted to do my son, but my son got in touch with him, and he's an EMT. He's a captain of the fire department up in Seattle, and as soon as he started talking, he said, hey, you know, we can use you. We got two nurses, but we can even use an EMT. This is a little side story, but it worked out fine, because on the flight, one guy had some kind of an attack. A son had his little bag along. A thing that really got to me, that guy was just two seats ahead of us. The next two guys was there when it was over. One guy says, if anything ever happens to me, I want that guy working on me. That did something for me. You know,
they were talking about your son.
Yeah.
Proud papa.
Yeah. Yes, very.
That whole experience from taking off to all the things you saw in Washington to coming back to a cheering crowd for you, what was the most meaningful part of it for you?
I'd like to say, can I say three? The vets back in Baltimore put on a big dinner for us. That was great, you know, talking with us and all that stuff. The next one was the reception we got when we came into Baltimore. All kinds of people out there to greet us. And then the next one was on our back then at Fresno, and we were way late. We thought, oh, well, nobody will be there to meet us. There was a mob. So that was three.
I remember it well. Well, I'm sorry for making you so emotional. I know none of this is easy to talk about, but it's so powerful for the rest of us to know that you lived it and that it was not easy and that it took great sacrifice to win that war. For those of us who weren't around then, who didn't live through World War II, what do you think is important for us to remember and understand?
To be very patriotic. This country needs a change. We're slipping around from the... And I don't want to be a good person, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But we had a good generation back in those days. All the things that everybody done, I thank them all. I thank them all.
Well, we thank you. Thank you for serving, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. Is there anything else that you think we need to know?
We did the right thing. Otherwise, what would it all have been? It was a terrible sacrifice. When I left my mama... 30 months before I saw her again. I know she went through hell because they were getting all the reports back, all the things they were going through. And as a matter of fact, this kamikaze stuff started at the Philippines. However, the government and the Navy and us had, they put a clamp on the news. That news didn't get back until we got to Okinawa. The things like my mother was going through and other people's mother. Everybody had hard times. We were a patriotic bunch. I'm not too sure we are anymore.
You said from the time you said goodbye to your mama, it was 30 months till you saw her again. What was it like when you saw her again?
Heartbreaking and, you know, good heartbreaking, crying. Of course, she's so happy that we made it. It didn't mean that much to me then. Something we did and we just did it.
One last thing I want to ask you before I forget, and I know you got a lot to choose from here at age 90, but what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
Being here. And I do say my prayers every night. I am thankful that we made it. And another little bad thing of our ship, of all the guys we knew, and we'd have these get-togethers. We started out every 2 years. And then we said, hey, we're losing some guys. We better shut this down to 1 year. Now we're down to just three left. Three. So all the old guys are gone. And here I am, thankful to be here. And with the way everything's turned out for us, it's been nice.
Well, it sure has been nice for us to spend this hour with you. Bob Ashburn, 90 years old, of Atwater, California. What sincere and intense emotion we heard today from this Navy veteran of World War II. And what powerful perspective he's left us with. We're out of time on today's program, but thank you for listening, and thanks to Bob for reminding us again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.